Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting stats here. Go over to electoral-vote.com. Tip of the hat to Marty, who sent this to me. It's interesting that while Alaska is still heavily favoring McCain, Obama's polling higher there at 38% than Kerry did in 04, 35, Gore in 00, 28, or Clinton in 96, or in 92 at 30%. So, interesting. Obama climbing in Alaska. Fascinating stuff. And tip of the hat to Senators Cantwell, Dorgan, Feingold, Johnson, Landrieu, Nelson, Sanders, Stabenow, Tester, and Wyden for having the courage to vote against this piece of legislation last night. As I said yesterday, I think we ought to cut some slack to the folks who voted for it, both the Democrats and Republicans who voted for it. It's sort of like you've got a really, really serious wound, and it's bleeding very badly, and it really needs 10 or 15 stitches. But right now what we're going to do is we're going to put one of those really, really tight Band-Aids on it to pull it together so you don't bleed out. And then after the election, probably after the first of the year, we'll get in there and do the stitches. I mean, it's an imperfect metaphor, but, I'm not saying that this was necessary legislation, but something had to be done. And given the current composition of Congress and given the fact that if what really needs to be done was actually done, Bush would veto it. I can understand why, for example, Senator Barbara Boxer, which frankly surprised me, voted for this. So I'm not going to condemn any of the Democrats who voted for it. And I want to congratulate those Democrats and Republicans, Jim Inhofe, for example, Sam Brownback, Dole, Roberts, Weicker, the serious and principled conservatives and the serious and principled progressives who voted against that legislation. Good on them. So the election is coming. Tonight is the vice presidential debate, of course, the election coming. And what is your vote going to mean? How will it count? We have with us Stephen Spoonamore, a computer cyber security expert and whistleblower. His website or blog site, whatmustbefed.com. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. Let's just start at the beginning for our listeners who are unfamiliar with the excellent blogging and writing that has been done about you and your situation over at, for example, Velvet Underground or bradblog.com or Mark Crispin Miller's blog. Stephen Spoonamore, who are you? Why are you here?
I probably don't fit strongly in the demographic of a lot of your users or listeners, but I've enjoyed your show a number of times.
You are a Republican, right?
Yes, I've been a lifelong member of the GOP, a very tiny and somewhat increasingly lonely wing of the GOP that in what used to be involved with things like Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act and conservation with a very large C and a very small G associated with government. But
kind of the Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower wing of the Republican Party.
It sort of disturbs me when I tell them my three Republican heroes are Teddy Roosevelt first, Abraham Lincoln second, and Nixon third, and they sort of do a double take, and I say he had some issues, but we also got the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the final codification of the Bureau of Land Management for public input all under Nixon.
Right.
So, there's good and bad to everything, but what I do is, as a profession, is I build very large computer systems. I'm a network systems architect, and most of your listeners, actually, as they are going about their day, probably are going to touch several devices that something I've been involved with the architecture of works. So one example is the what's known as the LSSP standards for a MasterCard interface. Mm-hmm. Those are the logical security and standard protocols by which every MasterCard all over the globe has information injected into the MasterCard. It's mailed to you for activation. The information is injected into banks, into credit bureaus. How that information is managed and transferred so that it ends up in a secure manner, I'm the principal architect of that, as well as half a dozen other major systems. So that's what I do for a living.
This knowledge, this background, this expertise brought you into the area of computerized voting.
Well, yes, and to go way back in the way back machine before many people were still trying to figure out if they wanted to use email, there was a company which in the late 90s called GovWorks that ended up having a very famous movie called Startup.com about its failure made about it. But during its rise to the top, it had a Future of Government Information Fair, and I was invited because the chief technology officer at GovWorks is a friend of mine, and he invited me to come look at this stuff and what they were up to, and I went, and I saw a display of, you know, the future of voting, and I just did a double take. I was horrified.
This was in the 1980s. This kind of reminds me of the Firesign Theater skit about the Future Fair.
This is 1998.
Okay.
1998. And I walked over to the machine, and within about 20 minutes, myself and my colleague had laughingly hacked through the system. We're looking at the underlying software. We're not writing, but we were able to figure out where we would insert code to change things. And I just went, this is a disaster.
Right.
And I said so quite publicly then. And I guess as a consequence of that, when the Florida debacle of 2000 occurred, all of a sudden you had, you know, now convicted felon Bob Ney, now convicted felon Jack Abramoff, and a variety of other convicted felons run to a room and come out with HAVA. And there
the Help were, America Vote Act.
Yeah, well, that's the title.
Yeah.
And there were only a couple of people who I think really thought through the extraordinarily catastrophic consequences of saying, wait, we have $4 billion we're going to hand to these underserved, you know, very dedicated and loyal county boards of elections, but they never have much money. They're always behind. There's a mishmash of equipment. All of a sudden, the Fed says, we have a bucket of $4 billion provided you use these automated computers to vote on. And only a couple of people, of which I was one, started jumping up and down going, whoa, 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 disaster, national security risk, fiasco.
Right.
And I keep hearing this thing. People go, well, why is the Republican? You're the ones that are always starting to go. I go, well, there is a small group within the Republican Party who certainly seem to snicker up their sleeve and think that they control this genie. And I sit there saying, you don't. If you build a hackable system, you do not know the outcomes which come from it. It is a national security risk. There are now hundreds of individuals out there with the capacity and certainly the motivation to steal pieces or all of an election.
Now, you have, and, we're talking with Stephen Spoonamore, and mustbefed.com, his website, and you have testified under oath that you were essentially the man in the middle in a cyber hack that might have occurred on election night 2004. Do I have that right?
No, well, not quite. What I've done is yes, I've given sworn testimony in regard to the Ohio case, which Cliff Arnebach and company are managing. And the reason I did this is I know during 2004, I actually spent a lot of personal time and effort trying to raise awareness of this when it was a much smaller community aware of it. And then I spent a good deal of time myself focused on Ohio to try and figure out how it would be stolen, because it was fairly obvious to predict Ohio would be the target.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a I personally had a run-in with Ken Blackwell. Just the strangeness of the context, I mean, in 2003, I was asked by the National Electronic Commerce Coordinating Commission, which is a very large organization funded by the state's attorneys generals and the state secretaries of state, to develop interface standards for communications, for secure information for state government. So I was chairing the committee doing the work that the states are supposed to be following. Mm-hmm. And at the convention in Boston, I made a very strong statement that while we are doing a brilliant job figuring out how to safely pay for a fishing license online, safely pay for a parking ticket, on the other side of things, we are creating a disaster over here in phone space, in voting space.
We're talking with Stephen Spoonamore. MustBeFed.com is website. And Stephen is a computer cybersecurity expert and whistleblower. And, Stephen, I want to get right into the story here. We have to take a commercial break. We'll do it right afterwards if you can stick around. Great. Stephen Spoonamore with us. I want to get into this whole thing about Mike Connell. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to teamster.org for more information. We're talking with Stephen Spoonamore, a Republican national computer cybersecurity expert and whistleblower. Stephen, we have only about 4.5 minutes here in this segment. Let's just very tightly pull this thing together. I think you've established your credibility of your position up to this point. Was the election in Ohio stolen? If so, by whom and for what reason in 2004?
I believe it was. In 2004, there was a number of people, including myself and some other teams, trying to watch as things occurred. There's a very famous mathematical anomaly now called the Connolly anomaly, in which 18 counties, all programmed with a single family, a very active in the pro-life community family who also has a company that happens to program voting tabulators, has this extraordinary event where John Kerry receives votes 10, 20, 30% below his exit polling numbers, and it's so bizarrely out of whack that a down-ballot judge at the end of the ballot ends up out, who's definitely a Democratic draw, ends up outdrawing John Kerry in those counties. It accounts for far more of the votes than Bush needed to win, and the reason I'm involved in this case, one, I helped hunt that down. I then said, well, in order to have done this, there had to be some kind of control tabulator or pre-programming capacity. Then the Rapp family ended up pulling many hard drives out of these before the Green Party recount. That's one flag that would immediately launch an investigation in any banking incident. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, I wrote and said, by a network architecture, there was probably a central controller, of which, of course, at first, Blackwell's office said that's impossible. And then other investigators came up and said, wait a second, on the day of the election, Blackwell switched control of the Secretary of State's office to computers outside of the state controlled by GOP. Well, that's how it was done.
Controlled by who?
It's a very classic way to steal money from a bank, and we'd immediately launch an investigation if it happened to one of my bank clients.
Right, but it happened in an election, so no election was – so Ken Blackwell transferred control of the Secretary of State's computer system into which all these voting numbers were coming, to whom and where?
Well, there's a company called Smart Tech, and they host, among other things, some of the White House email systems, Karl Rove, White House GOP,
a variety of other GOP sites. I was not aware that this switch has occurred. I wrote and said in order to have pulled off the hack this way, you had to have a central controller involved.
Mm. And it turns out that you were right.
Yeah, so I said, because this is what I do, is these networks. This is how you would do this kind of network hack.
Right. So who's
other investigators discovered this, and as soon as I saw it, I said, well, that's it. You've closed the loop.
Right. So who is Mike Connell?
Well, it turns out I work with a lot of these people. Mike and I are both involved in democracy and free speech advocacy work overseas.
Mm.
It turned out.
As Republicans.
As we discovered this other site, it turned out my friend Mike had also been involved in building some of the front end of the website. So I actually personally spoke to Mike about it while we were at a conference looking at Iranian dissident protection.
Mm.
I said, Mike, I got a problem here. I want whoever wins the vote to win. I know that you have worked with me on many of the things. I got a problem. You were involved with this. What happened? And he got very uncomfortable. Wouldn't talk about it. I said, Mike, you and I are like gun makers. I build powerful guns. You build powerful guns. If you give a gun to a responsible person, they can use it responsibly. You give a gun to a bad guy, he can kill people. Did you give a gun to a bad guy? And he basically said I may have been involved in something bad.
And I said,
go ahead. That's it. I mean, he didn't tell me anything beyond that. I just said, this is terrible, and I came forward and told people.
Now, you said he has admitted to me, speaking of Connell, he has admitted to me that in his zeal to save the unborn, he may have helped others who have compromised elections. In other words,
it's like we got into the topic. I said, why do you work with these people? He says, well, you know, these are some of the same people I know from that community. I know that's not your community. But he says, I'm not really sure that, you know, he builds front ends. He's not the person. And some people make him out to be this sort of uber lord of hacking. Mike's not that guy.
Right.
Mike's an interface. He's a front end builder. Other people, his front end would have to be involved with the information switching, but it's not where you actually write the program to do it. Somebody down in Smart Tech, down there where this other server farm is, they're the ones who are involved in the controllers.
And what state is that in?
I don't want to misspeak. I forget what state it is.
But it's not in Ohio.
This is where this stuff
was exported.
Okay. Yeah, it was either Tennessee or Kentucky.
Stephen Spoonamore, Republican Uber computer expert, you're convinced that the election in 2004 was hacked in Ohio at the request of Mr. Blackwell?
I don't know whose request it was at, but I do not believe that the vote in Ohio was accurate. I believe John Kerry won. I believe it was flipped for Bush.
Interesting. Stephen Spoonamore, MustBeFed.com, computer cybersecurity expert and whistleblower, recently testified under oath in court in this case. Stephen, thank you for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the True People's Radio, 34 minutes past the hour. Stephen Spoonamore, I asked him to stick around, and I just had a couple more questions. I'm sure they're the questions that are on your mind as well. And MustBeFed.com, his website. And let me add, Brad Friedman over at BradBlog.com has done some remarkable reporting on this, as well as Mark Crispin Miller at markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com, as I recall his website. Stephen, thanks for sticking around. Two quick questions. First of all, just to recap, you're a Republican computer security expert, one of the major guys in the nation doing this kind of thing for banks and others. In this King Lincoln versus Ohio Secretary of State lawsuit, you have testified under oath that you believe that the election in Ohio in 2004 had probably been hacked, and that the that Mike Connell had indicated that he may have played some role in that, and that the guys doing this hacking weren't your normal Republican operatives. They were people who were very active in the anti-abortion movement, and they honestly believed that by hacking the vote, they were saving the lives of unborn children. Is that a good summary up to this point?
Yeah, I think that sums it up, although I would characterize Mike's involvement as he knows them. I don't think he was actively involved.
Right, but he knows what's going on, and he's been subpoenaed now, but he has not yet testified. You have testified. So the two questions that immediately come to mind, number one, what can we expect in this election? And number two, what should my listeners do to prevent this from happening?
Well, advocate as much as you can for the best possible voting technology, which is called a paper ballot. And I always refer people to Canada, Germany, and England, where people go to the polls, they get a ballot, they fill it out with a pen, it's locked in a box. This worked in Iraq, by the way, for the glorious first election of Iraq. And then with as many people from the public as you wish to attend, under representatives of any party who wish to attend, trust individuals, bank tellers, or people count the ballots by hand, and you post at every precinct the result of the precinct, and then at each step of the information along the way, in a public manner, you transmit the information. It's cheap, it's effective, and it's the most difficult thing to hack. I make my living building computer systems, and I'll just emphasize to people, you cannot build a secure system to count votes, because all secure systems depend on full identity management of who is doing it. I can protect your credit card because I know it's you, and if it's not you, your phone rings asking you if you make the charge. Your identity is linked to the transaction. Voting, by definition, divorces identity from the transaction. You cannot link them legally. So as soon as it becomes anonymous, nobody can check if it's been changed. And there are literally hundreds of ways to hack a computer, hundreds. Mm-hmm. The safest technology is a paper ballot. If you don't have the option of using one, I have no idea how to secure what you're doing. I personally demand an absentee ballot and vote on paper.
Yeah, so our listeners who are walking into precincts this fall – in fact, early voting has already started in some states. Our voters who are listening, our listeners who are walking into precincts and they are presented with a voting machine, A, should do what? And B, the message that they should, I get it, the message that we all should be communicating to our elected officials is, damn it, we want to go back to paper just like Canada and England and most of the rest of the world.
Actually, just like democracies do. Just say we want paper ballots like a democracy.
There you go.
Not whatever this weird technotopia we're trying to
do. Well, like we used to have. I remember when I was a little kid, 7, 8 years old, in our elementary school, it was the precinct, and my mom volunteered to be one of the people who sat at the table and counted the ballots, and there was a Republican and a Democrat looking over her shoulder. I mean, you know, this is not rocket science.
No, it's not. And it's cheap, it's effective, and it works. I mean, now you have these voting machines that are now 6, 7, 8 years out of date. Most of the stuff that was sold by Diebold's now so panicked about their legal liability, they've sold the entire company off to a kind of shadowy group of investors from Texas. And now you've got this situation on your hands where people are running around using outdated Windows CE underlying technology with older 2001 versions of Excel as the underneath program. Microsoft doesn't even support the operating system that many of these people are voting on. The code is running on old chips. It is utterly and completely insecure. I mean, the number of reports on the web, there's demonstrations on the web of how to hack these machines in under a minute. It's nuts that they're still out there. It's nuts. I want my democracy back is what I want. I don't care who wins the election. I just want to know that whoever got the most votes actually gets the office.
Yeah, okay. Very well said. Stephen Spoonamore, MustBeFed.com, the Republican computer cybersecurity expert and whistleblower. Stephen, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
Very good talking with you. You're a very articulate spokesman for your point of view, and I appreciate it. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Actually, Just before I get to your calls, I just very quickly wanted to, the New York Times today has this marvelous on their interactive on their electronic version, how the credit crisis unfolded. And they're you're looking at credits, default swaps in the first screen, and you see this explosion on Wednesday, September 17th over Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, pushing up above 800 basis points. In other words, the cost of a credit default swap. The yields on three-month treasury notes, you see them going from 3% in the beginning of 2008 down to 0.06% on the 17th of September. This was, September 17 was the day that everybody realized, oh my God, the system is crashing. Money market fund flows, typically, you know, 20, 25 billion, something like that. Tuesday, September 30th, $11 billion flowed out of money markets. The day before, September 29th, roughly $10 billion flowed out. And on September 17th, $85 billion flowed out of money markets. These are the super rich saying, we're getting the hell out of here. The week ending Wednesday, the 24th, outstanding commercial paper, minus $61 billion. I encourage you to get over to NYTimes.com and just look at this interactive, how the credit crisis unfolded. Long-term corporate borrowing rates, they're now at 7.8%. They've been below 6% for most of the year. They're spiking right now again. The three-month London interbank offered rate, the so-called LIBOR rate, this is, you know, the rate at which banks offer money to each other. On Thursday, September 18th, 3.2%. Now it's over 4%. So this is not good. The net percentage of lenders tightening their loan standards, it was below zero. In other words, they were loosening their loan standards through most of 04, through all of 04, through some of 03, all of 04, all of 05, all of 06. And then in the middle of 07, they started tightening their loan standards 25%. And then in 08, they tightened them 50%, and now they're up to about 60% to small and medium-sized businesses. Consumer loans, they're up to 70%, and credit cards, they're up to 70%. So that all of the credit markets are tightening up. And, of course, the Dow was down 449 points on September 17th. It went back up 410 points on the 18th. It was down 778 points on the 29th of September. In other words, it's going nuts. And if my recollection is correct, if we go back about a year and a half, the Dow is down about 22% from its peaks, which is consistent with the kind of numbers I was reading to you yesterday from the New York Times in 1929. So anyhow, this is a real problem. The bill that was passed last night by the Senate that is now before the House of Representatives is not a solution. What it will do over the short term is probably it'll buy us a few weeks and maybe a few months, and it'll do so at a great cost. But given the nature of Congress, given the makeup of Congress, given the fact that most people in Congress don't even understand these issues with any significance or depth, the president clearly doesn't, and he's going to play Herbert Hoover. He will veto any efforts to create a real fix, a bottom-up fix. This is probably the best we can get. I salute those members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, who voted against it, and I'm not going to condemn those who voted for it. So that's where I'm at on that. Stan in the Bay Area, listening on Green 960. Hey, Stan.
One for more options.
Whoops. I guess Stan is gone, and Ken in Tennessee just vanished. Here, let's try Patricia in Sacramento. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, Tom, I just wanted to quickly touch on what you were just talking about, because in the Associated Press this morning, the article was titled Stocks Decline on Unemployment Factory Reports.
Right.
And basically it's saying that investors are pulling money out of the market because they're concerned that the $700 billion bailout plan will not be enough to actually stimulate growth.
Which is true, because it's putting very, very little money in at the bottom, which is what stimulates growth. All it's doing is plugging the bleeding at the top, and that's a serious problem. And the fact that unemployment is up, that we've lost over 600,000 jobs just since the beginning of this year, that it's getting harder and harder for consumers to get credit, and because they don't have decent jobs and they don't have the wages that they need, they've been financing their purchases with credit. They can't get that credit anymore. So everything is down. You know, housing prices are continuing to fall. Car prices are falling. Used car prices are falling. Car imports from other countries are declining. car sales are declining. I mean, right across the board, what we're seeing, Patricia, is the structural stuff that precedes a severe recession or perhaps even a depression. And the way that you fix that is to do what Congress tried to do in 1932 and Herbert Hoover vetoed. He actually vetoed, which is you put money in the hands of consumers. And it's what Franklin Roosevelt did, and it worked. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Another song from GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go, get real close. Strangers in the night, exchanging gunfire, liberals so uptight, call me a liar, challenging my war, before my term is through. Something in their eyes is getting scary. Keeping to my plan is getting hairy. Every day it's hard to do the things I do. Justify my fight. Please, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly on the right. Keep my agenda on the burners burning bright. Because I'm so uptight, demonize the left today and take their right to speak away.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we can incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah. 51 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Downright crazy stuff going on. The Dutch city of Eindhoven is to award credit points to street prostitutes in exchange for good behavior. This is from the BBC. Prostitutes with enough points will get street miles from the city hall, with which they can use to buy designer clothes and furniture. Yeah, please behave when you're out there on the street. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Well, since we're talking about voting, which is my area, I'd like to make a few quick points to
add.
What Stephen said. I'd say overall the situation is worse than it was in 2000. We have not improved much, which is actually more of a reason to vote, because if we have overwhelming numbers of people voting, say, for Obama, it's harder to throw the vote.
Right. If they're going to steal 5 million votes, we need to show up with an extra 10 million.
Yeah, so don't shy away from voting. It's more reason to vote. And the deadline to register in most of the country is tomorrow.
That's right.
You have to, most places 30 days have to register out. 30 days before the election.
Yeah, so please register and also make sure that you're registered. Verify your registration.
Yeah, for a lot of places like Colorado, you can go to the website, the Secretary of State's website, and see if you're registered.
Right, and canivote.org will take you to the Colorado or any other website. It seems that most of the Republican states, it's not all that easy to figure out if you're registered online. In most of the Democratic states, it is, oddly, you know, where the Secretary of States are. One or the other of those parties. But you wanted to make a point about not mailing absentee ballots, Jeff?
Yeah, it's, you know, when you're going to the mail system, you're risking that it may never get there. It's an insecure stream. So you want to drop off your absentee ballot.
Yeah, although the, you know, mail typically is pretty solid, but if you drop off your absentee ballot, you have the added benefit of being able to confirm that you're actually registered to vote when you do it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you're already going to be confirmed if you get the absentee ballot to begin with.
Oh, if you get it in the mail, right.
Yeah.
Okay,
but
good
if
point.
You're dropping it off, I mean, a lot of people wait until the beginning of November or whatever to mail it, and there are a lot of absentee ballots that don't get in time. They're risking the time thing, too.
Yeah, excellent.
One thing, though, we must always remember, even though we're doing, one of the problems with mail ballots and absentee ballots is they're more centralized, and the counting is still done by central machines that are error-prone. They're still counted by computer.
Right.
We need to get to decentralized precinct-level counting.
Yes, absolutely, of paper.
and
we all have to work on that, and all have to work on it.
Cast and count your vote on paper is a thing we need to say. And the last one, of course, that I'll repeat over and over, the counties, the election officials need volunteers you know, for as poll workers. The watchdog organizations are great, but why not be one of the people that's working directly? So you actually, as you're working, you don't need a watchdog because you're the one doing the job right.
Right. Get on the inside. Volunteer as a poll worker with your local county.
They really need help.
Right. And take that Tuesday off from work and you know, take it as a sick day or vacation day and be a poll worker. What a great thing. Jeff, thank you very much. And I, as always, appreciate you sharing that, your expertise with us. Alan in Tennessee. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Tom. I just want to give you information about that, what Stephen said. It was a company, it was in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Ah, so the counting of the votes in Ohio was outsourced to a company in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
At Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I forgot that the senator, I'm sorry, the schmuck that ran against Harold Ford, that was one of the companies that he owned on the side. He's a senator right now. I forgot his name. So,
oh, really?
Yes, the one that ran against the, Harold Ford, that he was running that ad, that stupid ad. So, I'd like to send you all this information. Can I email it? I don't want to take too much of your time.
Yeah, would that be Corker or Alexander in Tennessee, the senator?
Oh, Corker.
Senator Corker.
Yes.
So he was one of the own. Oh, man. Yeah, you can email me the information. My email address is on our website at tomhartman.com. It's tom@tomhartman.com. So, and it does come to me. Alan, thank you very much, and thanks for sharing that. Max in Los Angeles. Hey, Max.
Hey, good afternoon. Good morning, Tom. I am absolutely grossed out that it comes down to tax cuts again.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
in the end, their principles all rely on giving away tax cuts. They've demonized taxes. I don't think people should be grossly overtaxed, but we have to pay for stuff in this country.
Yeah, well, because if we don't, our children will, with interest.
Without a doubt. We have to face the facts that we have a certain way of life and a standard of life that we appreciate and love, and that requires paying for it.
Yep. Very, very well said, Max. Thank you very much. And amen, let me just add. Dan in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Dan. Just about a minute
Tom,
before we got
to how you doing, Tom?
Listen,
first of all, as I watched Obama speak before the Senate last night, I saw Bernie sitting behind him there.
Right, with his hand over his mouth like he was trying to prevent himself from erupting.
Oh, my God. He looked like a mix between pain, nausea, and massive frustration.
Yeah.
Poor guy. You got to ask him tomorrow what he was thinking.
I know. I will. I intend
I wanted to know, and maybe you can talk about this with Bernie tomorrow, too, or if you do. You know, I'm going through career transition myself, and I have colleagues and friends who are looking for work, but unemployed for a while. This whole credit crunch, I mean, we're starting to find now that a lot of times employers are checking your credit records just as a requirement for you to even have a job with them.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's discriminatory.
No, it's perfectly legal, Dan.
It's very unfair.
It is. But it's perfectly legal. And I Katie Couric on the CBS, and thank you for the call. Katie Couric on the CBS Evening News last night did a great piece on the 10th cities. This one was in Reno, Nevada, that are springing up all over the country, where people who were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, quote, normal middle class, right? They were the middle class employed, are literally living in tents because there's nothing else. Peggy Noonan kind of coming up next. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, strange stuff going on out there. Welcome back, by the way. Just got this email from Dave. He says, my brother's girlfriend received a call today from the local Obama headquarters. Left a message. Here's the message from his brother's girlfriend. The so-called local Obama headquarters. Somebody called, left a message on her voicemail that said that they were the local Obama headquarters and they wanted to encourage me to vote for Obama on November 11th and urging me to call back if I wanted any more info. I did call back intending to inform them that the election day is November 4th, but could not reach anyone because the call couldn't be completed according to the number that was given. Just thought you'd want to know. So the local Obama headquarters around the country are now calling folks and saying, don't forget to vote for Obama on November 11th. Very, very strange. Very strange. I wanted to share with you Ron Wyden's statement. He's my senator, one of my two senators, he and Gordon Smith, hopefully soon to be Jeff Merkley. Gordon Smith is the Republican senator from the state of Oregon, the guy who owns Smith Frozen Foods that employs illegal aliens. But Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, a good guy, he voted against this thing. And this is the statement that he issued, and I thought it was last night. He voted no. And I thought this was a very eloquent summary of this. So I wanted to share this with you. He says, Americans are hurting, and Congress is rightly being called to action. But if history has taught us anything these last few years, it is that no matter how great the rush to judgment, Congress has an obligation to take the time to ask tough questions and make certain that the action it chooses is arrived at in a thoughtful fashion. This is particularly the case on those rare occasions when we are considering legislation of this magnitude. In 2004, Congress rushed through the process of authorizing the Iraq War, failing to verify the answers to the questions it received from the Bush administration, and 5 years later, we have spent $600 billion on the war in Iraq. Now in 2008, we have been rushed into voting on a package that would spend $700 billion in a far shorter period of time to address the credit crisis that threatens our markets. In my judgment, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon said, in my judgment, the bill we are considering tonight leaves far too many questions unanswered and misses the mark in addressing both the causes and potential cures for the current crisis. First, the bailout package provides help to large institutional investors who took foolish risks. Rather than extending assistance to get credit flowing at appropriate levels again to shore up confidence in our markets, it is likely that much of this money will go to those who don't deserve a taxpayer bailout for their miscalculations. Ron Wyden says, wealthy investors who ought to know better shouldn't be allowed to gamble with taxpayer money. Second, in the Senate in this package is still failing to address any of the regulatory lapses that created an environment ripe for greed-driven abuses. There should, at a minimum, be a commitment to votes on reining in the worst abuses that led to this crisis. And third, there is not one bit of assistance in this package for homeowners struggling to make ends meet. My constituents don't understand that, and neither do I. If even one of these issues had been addressed in this package, I might have been inclined to vote for it despite its imperfections. I continue to think that Congress should act and help restore confidence domestically and abroad in U.S. markets. For that reason, I am voting against this bill tonight. This is last night he issued this press release, with great reluctance, and hope that the Senate is given a second opportunity, as the House will now receive, to put forth a more thoughtful response that will deserve and garner the trust of the American public. In other words, basically what he's saying is, okay, guys, in the House of Representatives, it's yours now. Turn it into something progressive. Well, I, you know, frankly doubt that's going to happen, because there are so many conservative Democrats, and there are so many total whack job Republicans, because the Republican Party, under Tom DeLay, conducted, and before him Newt Gingrich, conducted basically a purge of all the rational, all the reasonable, all the intelligent, all the moderate, and frankly all the honest, most of the honest Republicans. I mean, they just purged them. So, if that's Peggy Noonan, by the way, Chris, so we'll put her on the air. This vote is made slightly more difficult by the late inclusion of my legislation to reauthorize county payments for 4 years. This was legislation that I authored over a year ago with the majority leader, he says, as well as Chairman Baucus and Chairman Bingaman. And then he kind of gets into that, and he says, in closing, I want to add that I understand the difficulty faced by the leadership on both sides of the aisle. They've earned my admiration for the way they have put partisanship aside in the interest of moving forward for our nation. I want to say, you know, just personally, I absolutely echo Senator Wyden's sentiments. This is, as I said, this is an imperfect piece of legislation. I will not condemn anybody who voted for it. But the reason it is imperfect is the same reason that in 1931 and 1932 that Congress was unable to pass, Congress tried to pass progressive legislation that used the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to put actual money in the hands of citizens rather than just John D. Rockefeller and his buddies, or J.P. Morgan, basically, back then, and his buddies. And Herbert Hoover vetoed it. And that's the problem right now. if legislation that actually accomplished what Senator Ron Wyden was recommending, is recommending, and what I know Bernie Sanders is recommending, and many of the other principled Democrats who voted against this. Now, the principled Republicans voted against it for a completely different reason. But the principled progressive Democrats who voted against this voted against it because it doesn't accomplish what really needs to be done. On the other hand, it will buy a little time. It'll buy time until the election. There's a good side and a bad side to that. The bad side of that is that America is not going to realize before November 4th how bad the disaster is that 30 years of Reaganomics, and this is what Nancy Pelosi said in her speech the other night, the right-wing ideology, how they've destroyed our country. We have gone from being the wealthiest country in the world and the largest creditor in the world to the largest debtor in the world and the most impoverished country in the world. We are in debt more than any other country on the planet. And you and I personally are in debt to the tune of about $100,000 a piece. I mean, it's nuts as individual taxpayers, number one. So Reaganomics, 30 years of Reaganomics has wiped out any kind of credit that we had, number one. Number two, we are now the largest net importer of oil in the world, and we're importing much of it from very unsavory places. And yet the conservative ideology says, oh, to do anything in a big and serious way about that, that's socialism. And number three, we've shipped all our jobs overseas. We no longer make anything here in the United States anymore. I mean, that in and of itself is a terrible disaster and tragedy. I mean, you just go right on down the list of the things that we had in the 1930s. We grew our own food. We made our own clothes. We made our own cars. I mean, it's so tragic. We are having to borrow $1.6 billion every day. Our government has to borrow just to make payroll. Just to continue operations, we have to borrow that. Who are we borrowing it from? The Chinese, the French, the Germans, the Saudis, the British. We're borrowing it from all over the world. At the same time, because we don't make anything here in the United States anymore, we're buying things from all over the world and we're sending them dollars. What are they doing with those dollars? Well, for example, and I think it's a great thing. You know, one of the largest solar companies in the United States is going to be building a new factory right here in Oregon. But it's not a U.S. company, so the profit is going to go overseas. I mean, it's a wonderful thing that they're building the factory here. And the fact of the matter is that it's a real sad statement of the tragedy of America that American companies can't do this anymore because, A, the really big transnational American companies are stashing all their money overseas like Hewlett-Packard did under Carly Fiorina. And B, the companies that are left, the medium and small size companies in America who are the real engine that drives a country, the real engine that builds an economy, they're going broke. They're growing broke in large part because we're not enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act anymore in the United States. If you don't enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act, you get these very, very large, essentially monopolistic companies whose primary business model is to wipe out all the small local competitors. I mean, this is the business model of Walmart. Every time Walmart moves into a community, on average, 110 businesses go out of business. Local, small, locally owned businesses, on average. And that kind of behavior is ultimately destructive to America. Again, it's not the fault of an evil Walmart. It's the fault of a system that was created when Reagan decided in 1982 to stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and nobody has since then. It's the climate that was created when Reagan came along and said government is the problem, not a solution. That it is the climate that was created by the idea that we should stop paying taxes and hit our kids with the rent.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your hands if you're
helping you win the water cooler wars. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. You know, just go over and take a look at economyincrisis.org. The Great American Sell-Off, a disastrous habit. $2,068,357,000,000. This is the money spent by foreign entities to buy out American companies since 1978. Foreign ownership of U.S. industries, 97%. Our sound recording industries. Commodity contracts dealing, 79%. Motion picture and sound recording industry, 75%. Metal ore mining, 65%. Wineries and distilleries, 64%. Book publishers, 63%. And on it goes. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, it is just extraordinary. And why? Because of insane trade policies. Because we used to protect our economy. We used to protect our manufacturers. We used to protect our retailers. We used to prevent big monopoly, essentially. It used to be against the law. In fact, it's still against the law. It's just that the law isn't enforced. The game of monopoly was rolled out in the 1930s to help people understand how, in part, how we got here. Or was it the 1920s? Anyhow, whenever it was back in the day, right? Back before I can remember. This and the wire services, in an indication he's less than confident about his running mate's ability to perform at the vice presidential debate tonight, Republican presidential nominee John McCain confirmed plans to hide inside Governor Sarah Palin's podium during the televised face-off. Senator McCain had hoped not to resort to such draconian measures, but after reviewing tapes of Governor Palin's disastrous interviews with CBS's Katie Couric, he reportedly told aides, "Damn it, there's no way I'm going to let that doofus take me down." The Arizona senator plans to crouch inside the podium out of view of the audience, whispering key bits of information to Governor Palin, such as the names of any Supreme Court decision other than Roe v. Wade and the names of well-known newspapers and magazines she could pretend to have read. On the Democratic side, Senator Joe Biden said he hoped to emulate Abraham Lincoln's performance in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Said Biden, "That was truly one of the greatest moments in television history." Thank you, Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. But this is a serious issue. This is a serious issue. And this $600 billion bailout package or $700 billion, you know, whatever it turns out to be. I mean, it's a shame. You know, it's just a shame that this is what's happened. But we have to acknowledge the political reality. Right now, there is not a progressive majority in the House of Representatives. There isn't even a solid Democratic majority, old-fashioned, big-D Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. Because there are so many Democrats who are elected from very conservative districts around the United States who themselves are essentially Republicans who are in drag as Democrats. There's about 40 of them. And so, therefore, Pelosi does not have a majority, even if she wanted to get more progressive. Now, hopefully that's going to change. You know, some of those Democrats may lose their seats, but, you know, in this election, don't want them losing their seats to Republicans. But hopefully enough Republicans will lose their seats to actual progressive Democrats that the conservative Democratic caucus will become increasingly insignificant. Right now it's about half the size of the progressive caucus in the House of Representatives. That should tell you something. And similarly in the Senate, we need to get to 60 votes in the Senate. And frankly, in my opinion, we need to replace Harry Reid with Hillary Clinton. I would love to see Hillary Clinton as the Senate Majority Leader. I think she'd do a great job. I think that she really would do a great job. By the way, revealed Governor Palin in her campaign against protection for the polar bear. This is from The Guardian in the UK. The Republican Sarah Palin and her officials in the Alaskan state government drew on the work of at least six scientists known to be skeptical about the dangers and causes of global warming to back efforts to stop polar bears from being protected as an endangered species, The Guardian can disclose. Some of the scientists were funded by the oil industry. In official submissions to the U.S. government's consultation on the status of the polar bear, Palin and her team referred to at least six scientists who have questioned either the existence of warming as a man-made phenomena or its severity. One paper was partly funded by the U.S. oil company ExxonMobil. You want to know whose pocket Sarah Palin is in? Yeah. Yeah. There you go. And Palin Bingo, by the way, you want to just in time for tonight, go to palinbingo.com. You can print out your own bingo cards, and every time she says one of these magic words, you can drop something on the square. I frankly think we should make it a drinking game. Well, actually, maybe not, because, you know, it could be dangerous. Maybe a fist bump game or something. I don't know. But and what would be your favorite words for the game? Let's see. It couldn't be Charlie. Maybe Gwen. Gwenny. I don't know. It's what's she gonna say? What? How's my mother-in-law's name is Gwen. So it's a nice name, you know. But so what's Is she gonna say I'd like my lifeline? What are your favorite Palinisms? There's gonna be a new term coined out of this, the new terminology. By the way, Phil Proctor sends me a CEO, Chief Embezzlement Officer, CFO, Corporate Fraud Officer, bull market, a random market movement causing an investor to mistake himself for a financial genius.
Right. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. 34 minutes past the hour. 1992, 16 years ago. By the way, speaking of time, just a little bright note. 109 days, 10 hours, 53 minutes, 57 seconds until George Bush leaves office voluntarily. 16 years ago, one of the two senators from the great state of Michigan was Don Riegel. And Don Riegel was in the United States Senate, laid out to Alan Greenspan how, starting in 1980, what a coincidence, the year Reagan was elected, starting in 1980, our trade balance started going very, very negative. It started going south in a hurry. And we started buying stuff from other countries like crazy as our trade barriers crashed around us. They were called tariffs. As they were taken down. And he makes the point that we were to the point in 1992 where we were borrowing $500 million a day just to buy stuff from overseas. And here's what Greenspan says in response to what Riegel identified as a real problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we are looking at this in probably two different sides of the balance sheet, if I may put it that way. In effect, what those data also suggest is that foreigners are putting their savings in the United States and investing.
See, and Greenspan says, isn't that a great thing? We're so broke. We're you know, all these foreign companies are coming in and they're building factories here. And in fact, he goes on to say it's the only thing that's keeping us going.
And indeed, the current account deficit, which is the obverse of what you point out there, is one of the means which enabled us, even though we had very low private savings and a significant drain on those savings from our federal deficit, to maintain at least a modicum of private domestic capital investment.
That's right, but we borrowed most of that money from them.
Indeed,
we did. They have lent us back money that used to be ours. So, yes, they've lent us the money, we're paying interest on the money, and in the end, we've got to give them back the money, don't we?
Eventually, we have to return it, and that's one of the reasons why I don't like the process of the very significant continuous current account deficits, as I know you don't like either.
Yeah, except, Mr. Greenspan, for the fact that you were right there from the beginning helping to make it happen. And he doesn't like it. Oh, man. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Barry in Branscombe, California. Hey, Barry.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Just great.
I'm completely flummoxed by this whole nonsense. You got to remember, I've lost it now. Anyway, Ronald Reagan's nonsense with Paul Volcker.
Sure.
In the late 70s, that was the first great repossession of the middle class.
Yeah, and actually it was Jimmy Carter who put him into place.
Yeah, but it was we've gone.
Carter was drinking some of this Kool-Aid too. I mean, we have to acknowledge that. Great deregulation began in 78.
Yeah, and we're going from trickle down to trickle up at this point. Yeah. But this is a very hard thing. In 1967, I had a guy who introduced himself to me as William King from Chicago and oil, cattle, and steel tell me that we had a great governor in California and he was looking for him to be president. And I said, no, that's not possible. I was an 18-year-old wide-eyed guy. And he said, no, he says, we're going to try him out in 76 and he'll be president in 80. And I said, what do you mean? I said, that can't happen. He said, that's the trouble with you people. You don't listen. And this guy was on a perpetual world cruise to visit his wife, who was also on a perpetual world cruise. And I've always been curious as to who this guy was. But anyway, this bill is bad. If you read read it at all, you realize that they can buy any of this paper.
Right. For any price, and then they can sell it for any price. So they could go, for example, to Goldman Sachs and say, okay, we'll buy that paper from you at 99 cents on the dollar, so you're not going to lose any money. And then we'll sell it back to you at 40 cents on the dollar, so then you can sell it at 50 cents on a dollar, and you can make another profit.
Yes, and that's on you only have to go to page 5 to see the definitions of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and it's totally wrong.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Barry, and very well said. And the setup of America, I'm not going to argue with that theory at all. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max.
Yes, good afternoon. If only Democrats could speak like you do on economic issues.
Well, some of them do. You know, Peter DeFazio's out there talking like this. I mean, Feingold. I mean, there's a bunch of Democrats who actually get it. The problem is they're the minority of Democrats. They're not the majority.
Well, let's get to specifics and what's going to happen in my town tonight. I don't think Palin's going to do all that good, but she's not going to crash and burn. What she's going to do, I think she's going to, they've got her prepped. And by the way, I'm sure she's very conversant in her own state on her own issues, but she knows nothing of national issues and et cetera, et cetera.
Right,
but I think tonight she's going to make Joe Biden defend liberalism. They're going to use that other L word, leftist. I really think she is. All she's got, and she's good at it, when she was introduced, not 35 miles from where I'm speaking, in O'Fallon, Missouri, a month ago, all she's got is put down an invective.
Right.
I mean, her whole speech to the Republican convention was put down. She even challenged Barack Obama's manhood at one point. Now, I'll give you the exact quote. How we expect President Obama to stand up to Vladimir Putin when he couldn't stand up to, when he can't stand up to Harry Reid? Inversely, challenging Reid's manhood. They've been attacking for years.
Right. She's a female Rush Limbaugh.
Well, yeah, it's Rush Limbaugh, and before, and I'm not saying he started this all, but who was the beginning of putting the press on the defensive? Spiro Agnew.
Sure.
And since then, you know, and this also goes to the Democrats for years and letting these attacks, or not even, their so-called not dignifying attacks, when they've challenged Democrats, everything from patriotism to manhood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, challenge calling them socialists, socialism isn't a dirty word to me, but to them and their base and their crowd, it is a filthy word. And the Democrats have never been able to defend this. I'm looking forward to this new And I've only heard sound bites of it, but there's a new, as you will probably know, there's a new documentary coming out called Boogeyman,
yeah,
A Life and Times of Lee Atwater.
Right. I have the preview of it at home. I haven't had a chance
Maybe
to look at it.
Maybe you've done a show on it and I missed it. I'm sorry.
I understand. It's absolutely great. Max, thanks for the call. Excellent points you make, and I agree with you, frankly, about how Palin's going to conduct herself tonight. We'll see. It's going to be very interesting. Mike in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I'm dead set against the bailout. I'm a lefty. I listen to your show every day. But, you know, I'm 52. I'm coming up on retirement. So I got major skin in this game at this point. And this is the same people and actually identically the same policies that got us into this. You know, it's like the analogy when you've dug yourself into a hole, it's time to stop digging.
Yeah.
When you've pumped yourself up into a bubble with loose credit, it's time to quit pumping. And that's the idea that people are throwing out that...
The problem here, Mike, as somebody who's looking at retirement, if any of your retirement funds are in the stock market, and if you have, for example, an annuity or anything like that or a pension fund, probably a good chunk of it is in the stock market. And if they don't do something like this, then, I mean, we've already seen a 20-some-odd percent decline in the stock market in the last year.
Right.
It's going to continue to go down, and it's going to go down fast.
Right.
My prediction is it's going to continue to go down no matter what.
Right, exactly. No matter what. But can I make one quick point about that? You know, any person that's, like, nearing retirement like I am, or, you know, say not 30 or not in your 20s, if you've got more than 20% of your retirement fund in the stock market,
you're nuts.
You're a fool, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really, you know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. I mean, I did the 401k in the stock market thing and stuff when I was in my 20s and 30s, but you don't do that when you're in your 60s. You don't wrap up your whole retirement in the stock market. That's crazy. So that, you know, that argument is really kind of disingenuous because the stock market is risky. It's not guaranteed. It has the possibility of high returns, but there's no guarantee, and there shouldn't
be a
guarantee.
But, for example, many states have invested and many municipalities have invested much of their pension funds in the stock market. You don't have any choice in that.
Well, if they've
got... if you've got a pension and it's invested in the stock market...
Right.
That's not your choice.
And if that's the case, then you've got the wrong person managing your pension fund.
Well,
okay?
You know, that may be the case, but you don't, you know, if you work for the state of California or the state of Oregon or whatever, you don't have any control over that. You don't have any say over that.
Well,
you
don't have to invest in those pensions.
Yeah, no, please, Mike, don't think that I'm defending this bill
I'm
not.
You guys,
from day one, I have opposed any and all of these Bush, Paulson, and now tragically Reid proposals.
I am, it's
the wrong way to do it,
right.
But what it will do is it will buy a few weeks and maybe a few months if they're really careful with how they do that. And if we get an Obama administration in and they do things right, then they may be able to put something on the back end of this that will fix it and make it work correctly. The same way that Hoover passed the Reconstruction Finance Administration or Corporation and did it wrong, and FDR came in a year later and said, okay, here's how to do it right.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
No surplus, now it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Yes, the balance of our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell the kids they'll have to pay. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. Could try to pay these bills, or sell Dick Cheney's pills, or put Congress on eBay. And we owe, 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 and we owe, we owe.
Yeah, we owe, we owe, we owe. Indeed, we do. And we are, my friends.
I'm taking my country back.
Taking our country back one congressional district at a time.
watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes.
No, the Republicans have made a mess. Sent our jobs overseas. They owe billions to the red Chinese. They blew the budget and botched Iraq. And it's time to take our country back. One of the people working to take our country back, Robert Hamilton. Robert Hamilton for forcongress.com is his website. Robert Hamilton, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning.
Great to have you with us. You are running for California's 49th congressional district, running for the seat currently occupied by Daryl Issa, the guy who thought that he was going to be the next governor of California. And ultimately ended up crying about it. Tell us about this this district and about the race.
Well, I see you're familiar with this colorful history.
I am.
A gerrymandered district that sprawls out extensively amongst three different media markets. It includes Oceanside, Camp Pendleton, where the Marine Corps base is. Comes east into Fallbrook, goes north into Riverside County as far as Paris. And Lake Elsinore and a little bit beyond. And then it goes south as well from Fallbrook, goes down, includes the heart of Rancho Bernardo and a gerrymandered finger that goes right into the community there. Goes back out to Valley Center and then up the mountains into Julian and out to Borrego Springs. So it's a very extensive district. And it's a difficult district to communicate with people in because it's so far out, so many different communities in two different counties.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at your website here, RobertHamiltonForCongress.com, and right at the top, United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America endorses Hamilton. A lot of great stuff here. John Elliott and giving you a plug, my good friend down in San Diego. What are the chances that you can beat Daryl Issa? You think you can do it?
Well, this is definitely an uphill struggle here. I mean, he is, they tell me, the wealthiest man in Congress. If not, he's in the top three, the wealthiest in Congress. Like I say, it's a gerrymandered district.
He made his living as a used car salesman, didn't he?
Basically. Well, he had something to do with the car business. It's a colorful history, as I say, so I would urge the people to just look that up on their own. I don't want to get into it myself.
Mm-hmm.
But he did take over a car alarm company at the right time.
That was it, yeah.
So
people can go to RobertHamiltonForCongress.com and toss a few bucks your way and help you out. What's your background? Why are you running for Congress, and what do you intend to bring to the House of Representatives if you're elected, Robert Hamilton?
Well, I'm running for Congress because I'm appalled at what's been happening in the last 7.5 years in our country and in the world. And I got involved here a couple years ago to help, helping Laurel Nicholson run for state assembly. And next thing I knew, I was deeply involved in party activities and an activist and president of the local Democratic Club. And as I was looking for people to run for local offices, which is the obligation of the president, people were asking me to run. And as I looked around, I thought, looking at the job that Daryl Issa has been doing, I thought I can do a heck of a lot better than he is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a typical platform here that the war was a blunder and we're spending way too much money and we have to get back to fiscal responsibility. We got a medical care crisis in our country. We have an energy crisis. All these things need to be addressed. But additionally to that, I find that Daryl Issa and his office pride themselves on only representing, and their people admit this, that they only represent Republicans.
Right.
And, that's fine if you're a Republican, but if you're anything else, that's not what the job's supposed to be. So what I want to do is get into Congress, roll up my sleeves, do the work of the people, and represent all the people of the district.
Mm-hmm.
That includes Republicans, it includes Democrats, it includes independents, it includes minorities, it includes senior citizens, it includes veterans, it includes students. So, as I say, all the people of the district.
RobertHamiltonForCongress.com is the website. And we're talking with Robert Hamilton. He's running against Daryl Issa in the 49th District of California, California's 49th Congressional District. This would be a plum seat to pick. And Daryl Issa is one of the most toxic guys in the House of Representatives, voodoo economics all the way, right-wing ideology all the way, one of the more outspoken right-wingers. He's scrambled California politics, went after Gray Davis back in the day and everything else, and he's scrambled national politics. And I would love to see Robert Hamilton, you replace Daryl Issa, and I encourage my listeners to get over to RobertHamiltonForCongress.com and toss a few bucks your way or if you live in the district, get or anywhere near it, get over there and walk the streets and get active. What, how are you conducting the campaign, Robert Hamilton?
Well, it's a grassroots campaign. So we've been out talking with as many people as we can. I walked on up and down Main Street, going and introduced myself to merchants. We're doing a lot of Hispanic work. I've been on some Hispanic radio doing Hispanic interviews. You know, I grew up in Havana, Cuba, and
so you speak Spanish.
I speak Spanish fluently, and a good part of my career was with American Express in Latin America in Caracas, Rio de Janeiro, as regional sales manager for that entire area, and also in Spain as director of marketing and sales in Spain. So I've done business all halfway around the world, and I've been around. And, you know, I can talk with these people. If we can get these people motivated and out to vote, we can do this.
Yeah, it's right across the board, we have to get everybody out there.
Yes,
and voting.
We do.
I understand that the McCain campaign is now running slash and burn ads against Joe Biden in Spanish, saying that Biden hates Hispanics. I mean, that and this stuff like that just isn't on the radar screen of the corporate media in America because they don't want to talk. You know, it's in Spanish, so they ignore it.
Uh-huh.
It's incredible. It's just incredible. So it's great.
What an outrageous thing to say, though.
Yeah, I know. I know. It is so wrong. Robert Hamilton for Congress, forcongress.com is the website. Get over there, check it out. Robert, thanks for being on the show today. Good
luck. Thank you so very much, Tom. Thank you.
I wish you the very best. Coming up, Naomi Wolf, social critic, feminist, and best-selling author of The Beauty Myth, most recently The End of America. She has a new book out. We'll talk about that right after the break, live in the studio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the third hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour, and I am pleased and honored to have in the studio with me Naomi Wolf. I believe we talked about your book, The Beauty Myth, many years ago, as I recall, and certainly most recently, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, which is on my list of everybody has to buy and read that book. And you have a new one out, Give Me Liberty, a handbook for American revolutionaries. Naomi Wolf, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so pleased to have you. Let me just move this a little bit so the folks who are watching our webcam can probably see you, if we can get this off to the side. There we go, the microphone. And tell me about the book, Give Me Liberty.
Well, as you can imagine, last fall when The End of America came out, I traveled around the country trying to kind of alert people to these very serious dangers that you and I agree about the seriousness of it. I gather from your remarks over many, many conversations with your listeners. I was telling people that there are these 10 steps to fascism that you always see and that always work when a leader is trying to close down a democracy, and that we're seeing them now in America. And unfortunately, the last 2 weeks, we've seen step 10, in a couple of ways. We'll get to that.
Federalize the treasury. Yeah.
And also deploy military in the streets.
That's right. October 1st. Yesterday was when the 3rd Combat Battalion or Brigade was redeployed to the United States with a mission under NORCOM, the North American Command, which was created in 2001.
Right. And this overturns almost since the beginning of our nation's history. Since 1807, we've had this bright line between civilian policing and military. We, the founders and the generation after the founders wanted to guarantee that we would be a free nation, that we would never have military directed by a leader occupying our streets and terrifying us in our homes and intimidating citizens, because they knew how powerfully that subdues people from having experienced it with George III's mercenaries.
Right.
And I'm sorry to say that essentially a coup has taken place as of October 1st, in that seizing control of chunks of the treasury and deploying personal military are the two hallmarks of a police state.
We have, there have been a number of conservative commentators who have noted this redeployment of the American military and have suggested that it is to prevent race riots in the event of the loss of Barack Obama, which, is a terribly racist meme to begin with, and B, is a bit of a setup.
It's more than a bit of a setup, Tom. I was just on a right-wing talk show for an hour, and the guy asked, well, how do you sleep at night? And I said, actually, I'm not sleeping very well these days. I'm absolutely terrified, knowing what I know about closing societies. I just wrote a blog that's going to be posted hopefully later today, basically announcing that the coup has begun and that it's time to arrest these people because they've taken over the government and they're starting to, I mean, I cannot tell you how serious it is, the deployment of military in the streets. What are they tasked with? They're tasked with crowd control. They're bringing the technology modules, quote unquote, of crowd control that they used on Iraqi citizens to use on U.S. citizens. What will they be armed with? Tasers and rubber bullets. Now, tasers, as well as, you know, guns. Tasers have killed 300 people in the short time that they've been widely available on the market. And rubber bullets can be so lethal that, you know, the English police forces stopped using them because they killed so many Irish people, Irish citizens. Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen, I fear, is that there's a setup that you're seeing right now, and I've been hearing it, too, from right-wing radio when I've done interviews of, well, these protesters are going to riot, they're going to get out of control. The mission of the 3rd Battalion is to, I beg your pardon, the 1st Battalion, is to, quote-unquote, among other things, subdue unruly individuals. And what you saw the RNC is, and what you're going to see, God forbid, but I'm braced for it in the event of any citizens questioning the outcome of the elections, is what you're going to see is unruly individuals being expanded to extend to voter registrants, people objecting to being purged from the voter rolls, people objecting to the vote being stolen.
They're already demonizing Acorn.
They're demonizing Acorn.
I mean, Acorn is the major whipping boy right now of the right, and this is just a group that is, it's sort of like they're carrying on where the Legal Women Voters left off. They're just registering people to vote.
Oh, God. All right. Well, this is very frightening. I mean, I had this moment a couple of days ago where a dear friend showed me some footage that your listeners can see on our website at myamericaproject.org or endofamericamovie.com. We're trying to get a movie out to alert people to the dangers before the election of the suppression of liberties. And it's terrifying footage of people being brutally arrested at the RNC. Yeah. And it was some of the only footage I've seen that was that violent because they confiscated the film of the reporters. And this footage survived because one of the protesters buried it. And I started to kind of well up in tears yet again at hearing this because this is even scarier than the mass arrests. I mean, this is the kind of story you hear in, you know, Russia in 1985.
No, I was there in Minneapolis when four of these guys dressed like Mutant Ninja Turtles. Mm-hmm. Only one of them had a badge, by the way.
Oh, my God.
Which was weird, you know, when some people went up to them afterwards. Only one of them could present a badge. So the question is, were the other three from Blackwater? I mean, where'd they come from? And they grabbed this protester for refusing, in a public street, you know, this is outside the security zone, for refusing to open his backpack, and threw him to the ground and started smashing his head into the pavement. And there's a whole bunch of people. We're sitting there in the restaurant watching this happen. And the restaurant across the street, which was more of a beer-drinking crowd, you know, was gonna, they burst into applause.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that this is what you're describing to me are exactly the kinds of scenes you saw in 1930, 31, 32 in Germany before the legal coup, before the small group of people legally took power.
Well, it's just like in Dayton, Ohio last week, right after this Obsession DVD was distributed in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. The day afterwards, a mosque, somebody put pepper gas into the window that went into the nursery, and here you had all these women and children gasping and choking and running out of the mosque, and it just reminded me of Kristallnacht.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a different
scale.
But
Tom, you're right.
You know, it's,
oh my God, you're right.
And Kristallnacht was to some extent driven by talk radio, oddly enough. I mean, you know, in fact, in Germany during that time, they had what were called public denunciations, where you would call your local talk radio show and name on the air people who were anti-German, and then the crowds would take care of them. I mean, let's remember the brown shirts were not government employees.
They were not. They were paramilitary.
They were volunteers, by and large. Actually, you know, it was almost like the KKK or the John Birch Society or something like that. The analogies are imperfect, and certainly this is not Nazi Germany in 1933, but too many of them are too close.
Right.
And as you so well document in The End of America, we're talking with Naomi Wolf and her new book, Give Me Liberty, A Handbook for American Revolutionaries. What, Naomi, in Give Me Liberty, if it's a handbook for American revolutionaries, what should American revolutionaries do short of, I'm assuming you're not advocating armed revolution, that would really bring this thing down in a bad way, I think. I just don't see. You know, I get people calling the show saying, I'm a Second Amendment defender because I want to have guns in case the government goes nuts. I want to be able to shoot back. And I'm like, come on. You think you can take on a tank, a half-track, a shoulder-fired missile? I mean, you know, give me a break. It's not going to happen. And I don't think appropriately it should. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, so to answer your question from earlier, Give Me Liberty is, in fact, a sequel because people are saying, well, what do we do? You know,
right.
What's the battle plan? And so I went back and looked for Give Me Liberty, which is supposed to offer the battle plan. I looked back at what the founders intended for America to be, and I don't just mean the well-known affluent white guys that we all know about. I mean the founding generation of ordinary people. Working people, farmers, enslaved African Americans, washerwomen, artisans, all of them captivated by this vision of liberty. And I wanted to get back to those core principles. What are these core values? Because we're being manipulated and brainwashed into forgetting what America is supposed to be so that they can control us,
right.
You know, further. And also what I offer is and I looked at how in closing societies, how do people fight back effectively? What works? And I offer those strategies. And I also offer the last third of the book as an actual practical guide to, well, here's how you form yourselves into democracy commando units so that you can hold your representatives' feet to the fire much more aggressively and outweigh the special interests. Here's how you write the media yourself, write your own op-eds. Here's how you leak to a reporter. Here's how you start a political movement. But in terms of what has to happen immediately, since the coup has taken place, I mean, the first step is psychological. We have to understand what's happening.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the coup took place in the Supreme Court in 2000.
That certainly laid the groundwork. And as you see with Germany, what happens is first there's legal groundwork laid, and then you get boots in the street eventually.
Yeah.
So the boots are in the street. And as you noticed, you know, the fine print of the bailout proposal that the White House wanted to rush through, drumming up hysteria, drumming up fear, would have given the president $100 billion in discretionary spending. So the definition of a police state is when a leader has his own treasury and has his own military. And he's defining these warriors, 3,000 to 4,000 of them on our streets, as his personal army. So the first step is recognizing...
We're out of time. Okay. We'll be right back with Naomi Wolf.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active. Damn it!
That's right.
Naomi Wolf with me here. Her new book, Give Me Liberty, a handbook for American revolutionaries. Her last book, The End of America, a letter of warning to a young patriot. They are both essential reading. And Naomi and I are going to talk for a couple of minutes here at the bottom of the hour. We're going to pick up some your phone calls. If you have questions for Naomi Wolf, we will be talking with her until 45 minutes past the hour, and then we'll pick up the news from Ellen Ratner. So, Naomi, first of all, how societies close. Let's just very quickly recap in the 5 minutes roughly that we have here in this segment. Let's quickly recap your last book, The End of America.
Sure. 10 steps. First, you invoke a terrifying internal and external threat. You often, it's a real threat that you hype if you're the leader who wants to close down an open society. Second, you create a network of prison systems outside the rule of law where torture takes place and legalized torture. Third thing you do is create a paramilitary force not answerable to the people, like Blackwater, the SA, the RDT, the Black Shirts, the Brown Shirts. Fourth, you create a surveillance apparatus aimed at ordinary citizens. And you and I were just talking about how my last blog post made some people step back because I was noting the harassment I'm starting to experience. And that could sound really extreme or, you know, is she telling the truth? But I'm getting more and more documentation from activists across the country who are also experiencing mail tampering, cyber attacks, surveillance. You know, many of the they're not just liberals. Libertarians are being surveilled, harassed by Secret Service, the RNC, and so on. The next step is that people start to infiltrate and harass citizens groups, and there's so many examples of infiltration that...
Right to the League of... Even to the... Including the League of Women Voters.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Six
Raging
is that...
Grannies.
Exactly. Six is that you start to arbitrarily detain and release citizens. Seventh is that you start to target key individuals, like you bring down people like Dan Rather, you bring down people like Bill Maher, you bring down the Dixie Chicks, or you do, you know, organize campaigns against them. Eighth is that you start to restrict the press. You see people like Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, who broke the Swift banking story, be called a traitor, you know, prosecute him for treason, prosecute him under the Espionage Act. You start to see arrests of journalists, like you saw at the RNC. You start to see the definition of terrorist expand to include people who look like the person next door, a saboteur, a spy, enemy of the state, expands and expands. So you've got the RNC 8, just ordinary American citizens who are, I met the brother of one of them, Ian Bicking. Monica Bicking has been charged with terrorism for protesting. She's a young American woman. She's facing $250,000 in legal fees and years in prison. She's terrified. Her brother's terrified. The ninth,
this is for protesting at the RNC.
Exactly.
Just protesting.
Protesting. The ninth step is that more and more laws pass that criminalize speech. And the tenth step is you start to see what we're seeing now, subversion of the rule of law, the White House ignoring subpoena requests or demands by Congress, you know, Sarah Palin ignoring the rule of law, ignoring subpoenas, the unilateral taking over of, I didn't mention this in the book, but this always happens, chunks of the national economy by the leader.
Right.
And you start to see step 10, making it easier to declare martial law, or you start to actually see deployment of troops.
So, Naomi, what do we do in response to this?
Right, thank you. And what
how
I wanted,
how do we respond?
What I wanted to say is that, you know, you and I in the first segment mutually brought each other to a state of despair and looking
moderate freak out.
Moderate freak out. and looking at what's really happening can do that. But that is why I need to keep focused also on the message of give me liberty, because it's so easy to tip into that abyss.
Right, and that's what they want. I made the note about torture. You mentioned, you know, the second or third point was you start torturing people. And the reason that they torture people isn't that they want to do anything to that particular person.
Exactly.
They actually want it publicized that
exactly.
they're torturing people.
Exactly
Pinochet
right.
only killed 6,000 people, but he made sure that everybody in the country knew that he was doing it.
Exactly right.
And that shut down all the dissent.
Exactly right, which is why I'm waiting. I'm braced for, you know, in a scuffle with unruly individuals. All it's going to take is one photograph on the internet or one clip of a protester being tasered to death or shot to death.
Oh, it's like it's already happened in the airports.
Right.
I mean, we've had three people now killed in our airports. You know, a woman who was chained to a desk in Phoenix.
I knew about her.
And she died. There was another woman who had a nervous breakdown and freaked out. She was running down the aisle, and they killed her. And then there was the guy with the backpack who ran away from the plane on the tarmac.
So
all three of them were killed.
So you gave me two new examples that I didn't know about.
And now no, you don't mess with the TSA.
You don't mess with the TSA, exactly right. So what we need to do is first, as I said, psychologically face it, because if we don't face it now, believe me, it gets worse.
Right.
The second thing we need to do is invoke the founders, invoke this great vision. And, you know, that's what I try to offer, these seven core values, because it is so empowering to reconnect spiritually, morally, ethically, psychologically with that energy these beautiful visionaries wanted us to have, that we are the ones tasked with defending liberty. Ordinary people are supposed to be leading this country. Ordinary people are supposed to be having the debates. And ordinary people are supposed to step up when a coup has taken place. And I felt very emboldened going back to the founders. I mean, the ordinary people who are not in the history books, as well as the well-known ones,
to
channel that energy.
We now know that the reason why James Madison agreed to keep the minutes of the Constitutional Convention secret for 50 years, and did, was because most of the guys in that room who were, quote, wealthy, were betraying their own class.
Interesting.
And you know, doing so out of a noble belief
right.
that they could create an actual small-d democracy.
Right, right.
And they did.
Yeah, and they did.
And we have to take it back,
exactly. And so to your point, the third thing, the last third of the book is the how to take it back.
Okay, we'll get to that right after the break. Naomi Wolf with us will be taking your call. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Fire it up, we push off, we're rolling.
love your quote, by the way. The sense of which is my conscience is not taking all the time.
In fact, Naomi just mentioning our quote for today from James Madison, his essay on property. Conscience is the most sacred of all property. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. Naomi Wolf sitting here with me in the studio live. And Naomi, you want to finish your point, and then let's pick up some of these calls here.
Sure. Well, in order not to despair, we have to understand the power that we have. And in addition to all these practical tools I want to offer citizens across the political spectrum, I think we're also in a heightened state of emergency. So today's blog is going to be adding to those action steps. It's not yet up, but I'm going to put it on the Huffington Post. It's going to be some more urgent action steps. For example, it's clear that a coup has taken place. So what happens in a democracy when a coup has taken place? Vincent Bugliosi makes a very good case in his book calling for the arrest of George Bush.
Prosecution of George W. Bush for murder.
Exactly. Yeah. The district attorneys and U.S. attorneys general can arrest George Bush on that basis. And now we can add, I think, charges of treason. So I am calling for citizens to call on their elected representatives to investigate the arrest of the people who have seized control. Well, you know, it's not as strong as armed resistance, but what I need to tell everybody is that there are only two options right now. It's going to take millions of people taking action immediately, and history shows that when millions of citizens rise up, there is no power on earth that can control them unless the state is actually willing to gun them down. So I've got a whole chapter on protest, for instance, and how to protest effectively, because the kinds of protests we're doing now are almost by definition sterile and ineffective. But more important is to understand that we need to think strategically in very, very urgent and radical terms. And so arrest and prosecution has to be, you know, sent out there, as does calling on Republicans, especially Republican senators and congresspeople and military leaders, to take action against the coup that's taken place.
We're talking with Naomi Wolf, her last book, The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, her current book, Give Me Liberty, A Handbook for American Revolutionaries, AmericanFreedomCampaign.org, the website, and 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's pick up some calls here. Steve in Eagle Creek, Oregon. Hey, Steve, you're up.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a background in emergency management. Consequently, my house is well prepared for the disruptions that we're going to be seeing here coming up shortly, I believe. What kinds of suggestions would you have for a person who is in a fairly secure position to help in on a neighborhood basis? Because I think I know that just about every American citizen that I've talked to is in a state of absolute and utter outrage over this bailout associated paper. Plus, didn't you write another book called What, the 101 Things to Do Till the Revolution?
No, I didn't. No.
So Naomi, thoughts on how we can prepare for disruptions?
I mean, there are.
This is not disruptions created by us. This is
right.
Disruptions created by the government.
Right. There's a section on literally how to dress when you're protesting effectively to protect yourself from tasers and rubber bullets. It's an update of the great Steal This Book by Abby Hoffman, where he was teaching protesters how to be safe when all they used were dogs and water hoses and mace. I mean, it's things as basic as wear a hunting vest, a football helmet or a motorcycle helmet, hiking boots, gloves, link arms, document the abuses that you're seeing. We need to understand that we have leaders of our army, but they need a lot more money. It's the Center for Constitutional Rights, it's the ACLU, and it's the National Lawyers Guild. These are the people who are going to protect us when we're arrested. They're going to get us out of prison, and they're going to push to change the laws so that we're not endangered.
Long before we get to the point of getting out in the streets, isn't there a political level
for activity.
Well, that's what I want to...
getting involved politically.
That's what I want to urge first. I mean, I've got this section on how you round up 20 or 30 of the people in your neighborhood, register them to vote, and then deploy their support, paradoxically. This is a hard thing for liberals to process because we're so used to complaining. But if you deploy them in a way that I call democracy commandos to support your representative at key times, right, then you've got a lot of power when right. you're negotiating.
We need to let these people know that we've got their backs. Let's pick up a couple more calls. We only have about another 5 minutes
right.
here, so we've got a Lawrence in Berkeley, California. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah.
Yeah,
what's
hi. This is Lawrence in Berkeley. How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to make a suggestion that in every city we need schools and workshops for organizing.
Mm-hmm.
We need for community organizing, because any successful movement has to be both massive and intimate. And we make an attempt for the massive part, but for the intimate part of linking people together in mm-hmm. small support organizations, we're not that good at it.
It's
a great suggestion, Lawrence. There are some starting points for that, and you know, drinking liberally, for example, as odd as it may seem, or Howard Dean's brother, Jim Dean's Democracy for America. They're doing mm-hmm. trainings all over the country,
mm-hmm.
you know, mostly on political action. I really think that we need to keep our eye on infiltrating and taking over the Democratic Party and turning mm-hmm. it back into something like Franklin Roosevelt did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roosevelt, when he became president, was dealing with literally fascists on the one hand and
right.
literally communists on the
he
other.
He also dealt with a coup. I don't know if your
yeah.
listeners are aware
oh, yeah.
of that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They're well aware of it.
Smedley
Butler.
Smedley
Butler, yeah, the whole thing. Yeah, absolutely. So
and Bush's grandfather was part of that coup, I think.
Yes,
worth knowing.
Yes. Good old.
Can
old
I just
president.
Add a plug sure. for one other national organization we've just
Please.
Started? We started something called MyAmericaProject.org, and many callers have asked me to repeat the website. It's where we're going to be posting this footage from the RNC of violent treatment. And what that is doing is there's a staffer standing by to literally direct you to one of 55 action steps, whether it's monitoring the vote, rounding up pressure on your representatives, calling a protest. And I also want to make a plug for mass protest. I've got, as I mentioned, a whole chapter on protest. One of the things you see in history is that when millions of people take to the streets, and I'll specify that in a minute, whether it's the Baltic states in 1989, where they brought down chunks of the Soviet Union, in Berlin, in the Philippines, restoring people power, it is incredibly effective. But right now, effective protest is illegal in much of the United States because of over-permitization, this 30-year assault on our liberties insidiously by making us get permits for very kind of sterile, restricted protests. The kind of protest that is going to oust these people will bring everything to a halt, and it's illegal protest, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can tell you to break the law, and it's a little dangerous now with these technologies, but this is categorically necessary across the country to stop business as usual. That is the only way you oust dictators who have just seized power effectively. And the last thing I want to note is tell your city councils, tell your representatives to refuse Homeland Security money. There's a new report. Police departments are saying we don't need it. It's draining money from law enforcement. But what's happening, and the RNC is showing this, is that cities are accepting millions in Homeland Security money, which then they're told to use to pay off the lawsuits that protesters bring against police for abusing them.
Right.
And it's a way basically to federalize domestic peacekeeping and to turn the peacekeepers against the citizens. It's
right.
part of the war.
This
so they're telling them to refuse the money.
It happened in 2004 in New York. You know, there's several. I think over $100 million has been paid by New York City now to protesters who successfully sued it. Some mind-boggling amount of
money. It's basically a way to ransom away our liberties without
yeah.
our even noticing.
Yep. Ted in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you're on the air with Naomi Wolf.
Hey, Naomi, Tom, God bless you for being out there for all of us.
Thank you.
Hey,
thank you.
2 years ago I started betting people quarters that George Bush would not step down in January 20th.
Right.
It appears I'm very right. I know that there's something wrong, basically wrong with the excuse of 9/11 and what happened. And it looks like they had something dramatically to do with it. And if these people would have gone to that extent, they are not going to step down. And I as a leader of this invisible revolution, will be at in D.C. to die for our Constitution. I'm going there to die. If they kill old men, to die for yelling about freedom. They're going to kill this old man. You'll see this old man die on television. Hopefully.
Oh, please, yeah. Don't go there.
Don't go to die, please.
Yeah.
But we get your passion and honor it. Naomi, what do you think the chances are? I frankly don't think that Bush is going to – I don't think he even wants to hold power. I think he wants – frankly, I see Sarah Palin as
exactly.
George Bush in drag.
You know, how are we the same person? I mean, this is incredible. We are
well,
so on
a,
the same page.
You wrote a great blog about it, in
Thank
fact.
You very much.
And that's, you know, that's the thing that I see happening is the possible theft of the election.
Well, I agree with you there. First of all, is this guy making the kinds of short-term decisions you make when you're going to be out of town and have no hand in things in 4 months? No, deploying the military on our streets is a long-term power base. I agree with Tom, who agrees with me, that Sarah Palin is a stalking horse for a Rove Cheney cabal continuing in power and basically creating a police state which will make future free elections pretty much impossible. Here's the reasoning. John McCain, I'm sorry to have to say it, actuarially has a disease and a demographic that has a 2 to 4 year survival rate. So, and I'm noticing that Palin keeps carrying water for Rove Cheney positions that are not McCain's positions, and she's surrounded by Rove aides and Rove speechwriters.
And she's openly contradicting McCain.
And she's contradicting McCain. So my analysis, again, is based on closing societies. Often a cabal will hold elections, but they'll put a telegenic front person ahead to, you know, be their stalking horse, and they continue to hold power after
That's
the election.
Right. Naomi Wolf, her books, The End of America, and her new book, Give Me Liberty, AmericanFreedomCampaign.org. Is there any other website you want to quickly
find? Yes, MyAmericaProject.com and EndofAmericaMovie.com, where you can download a film about the subversion of liberties and hold a screening before the election.
Great. 45 minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner up next.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Just a quick reminder, tomorrow I will be keynoting the Shining Dawn's Early Light on Spirit Science and Systems Conference in Spa, Indian Wells, California. We'll be doing our show tomorrow from our Palm Springs affiliate, KPTR, 1480 AM. This conference is sponsored by the Association for Global New Thought, AGNT.org is their website. If you want more information about it, or if you happen to be in the area, in the L.A. or Palm Springs, and you want to check it out, agnt.org. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, Talk Radio News, on the line with us in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Thank you. The news is coming so fast and furious, I don't even know where to start. I guess I'm going to start with the last first, which is Nancy Pelosi was talking, gave a press conference today. She said that there are going to be several hearings that will take place after this, and one will be on credit default swaps. Another is going to be on just the whole housing, you know, so that she essentially listed the kinds of things. She said that if they had more, she said she thought that they were successful in mending the bill, but that she wished they had more time. She wants to send a message of confidence to the markets. She said this is not our last act, but we also want to see if we had the 141 votes that we had before. Now, there's some Republican members of Congress who also are saying that it's going to lift the federal debt. These are the people opposed. They're aligned with the liberal Democrats for different reasons. And that Congress, that this is going to lift the federal debt to over $11.3 trillion. And they are saying that it would set a dangerous precedent in getting the federal government involved. And that also that the bill is going to, that they should have made it easier for families to pay off their mortgage. This is a Republican saying this. And that, there would have been bills to help people pay off those, foreclosures, 600,000 of them, but because of the intense pressure by industry lobbyists, the same industry that created this, they are paying off the companies and not the individuals. Now, so it's so fascinating to me watching this, how some of the Republicans and the Liberal Democrats are aligned. Also, Steny Hoyer talked today, and he gave a little press briefing. He said he believes that there are taxpayer protections in there, and they want to pay back the taxpayers first. But then he said something interesting. He said that the government will not be involved in the voting in these corporations or the management, although there will be greater oversight, because he said the government's not going to get into the business of running companies. Well, yes, but if you own them, don't you want to have a little bit of say into them?
Mm-hmm. You would think.
And he said that after the markets dropped, that things had changed in terms of the number of calls coming into offices, that, you know, it's sort of been 3-1 against the bailout, and then it really switched very much the other way. He also likened this to the U.S. financial. He called this a hurricane, and that if it does not pass, that we will have broad damage nationwide. They're not expecting to have any votes till Friday. They're also trying to, this is the good news, increase unemployment benefits. But that was something that they really wanted to focus on. Now, speaking of unemployment, jobless claims have now gone up to nearly 500,000 at 497,000 last week. First-time jobless claims.
Wow.
Factory orders went down 4% in August, and the economists had predicted 2.5% decline. So now we're down at 4%.
I think we are sliding into the second second Great Republican Depression.
What's happening, I mean, the good news is that I don't think McCain's going to get elected at this point.
It's going to take massive voter fraud to put him in office.
Right. Or as Brad Block calls it,
election fraud. Yeah, election fraud.
McCain then went after Obama this morning on CNN, and he said, "I'm proud of the work we did." He's talking about the bill, engaging the House Republicans. It's now going to be bipartisan and bicameral. And Senator Obama said he would phone it in. That's the difference. I suspended my campaign and put my country first. Excuse me. Then he got on the phone after the debate.
Right.
He didn't show up there. He did the phone.
Right. But, you know, reality isn't a requirement for a statement to come out of the McCain campaign.
Right. Pretty interesting. Couple other things that have actually sort of evaded some notice. There is Herb Nathan. He's a general counsel for the Democrats, and he has now filed a suit challenging White House privilege. And he said that Myers and some of the other White House people have a right to claim privilege, but they have to show up to do it.
And they're not even bothering to show up.
And they're not even bothering to show up.
Yeah. What do you think the probabilities are that the House of Representatives will vote to hold Karl Rove in contempt? I mean, this is something I've been pushing really hard. Don Siegelman's been on the show a number of times pushing it really hard. To contact your member of Congress, go to callcongress.org and pick up one of the 800 numbers, call Congress, and say, please hold Karl Rove in contempt at the level of the entire House of Representatives. What's it going to take?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Siegelman would have a better sense of it than me, and so would you.
We talked to him a couple days. He was on the show day before yesterday, and he said he's actually optimistic that it could happen if enough people call.
Right.
So
the
we'll
election.
See. Yeah. So we'll see. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com is the website. Check it out for a great news summary. Ellen, thanks so much. And great to have you on with us. Coming up tomorrow, of course, Friday, Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders giving us all the news from Washington and taking your calls and answering your questions. Plus, we're going to find out about Brave New Films' latest campaign. John McCain's health records must be released. And, of course, anything goes Friday. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active.
Hashtag you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.